suburban eastern Australia, an environment that has, over time, evolved some extraordinarily unique groups of Homo sapiens. But today, we observe a small tribe akin to a group of meerkats that gather together atop a small mound to watch, question, and discuss the current events of their city, their country, and their world at large. Let's listen keenly and observe this group fondly known as the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Yes, and after 423 episodes, we're still trying to figure out audio technical issues, despite all of the practice, dear listener. So, yes, sorry about the audio last week, and it still turns out I had errors in it, which I might get to fixing tomorrow. And now we're just trying to deal with Joe's audio, which is soft and muddy, and trying to fix it. And we're doing that in a mad panic before the start time of 8 o'clock. So, well, coming through loud and clear from regional Queensland, Scott the Velvet Glove. Scott, how are you?
Not too bad. G'day, Trevor. G'day, Joe. G'day, listeners. I hope everyone's well.
And possibly sabotaged by Peter Dutton for the abuse that Joe gives him in as a member in his electorate or as a voter. Joe the Tech Guy, are you coming through loud and clear?
Oh, I'm hoping so.
That's better. Yes, that's better.
Okay.
So
good.
All right, we'll keep working on that as we go. So, dear listener, oh, what a week, hey? What a week. We'll work our way through the different issues, have a chat about them, see where we end up. We'll talk a little bit about my anecdote in relation to the Bondi tragedy. We'll kick off a bit about housing affordability. I know we've done it lots, but there's more stuff come out. And I think we'll get on to just the way that the Labor and the Coalition are really now sort of reduced down to about a third of the vote each, which leaves a third for independents, and how we're moving to perhaps a European style of parliament that nobody's quite ready for yet, and Tasmania is the first example of that perhaps. And then we'll get on to Gaza and Israel and Iran and all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, there we go. So if you're in the chat room, say hello. John's in there. He's calling in from Glen Innes. Good on you, John. So, okay. Kicking off, grateful for. I'm grateful for the game of Quiddler. You guys ever played Quiddler?
No.
No.
Little board game, not that expensive. You can get it for under 20 bucks. Basically, you get dealt cards that have letters on them. The letters have a value, a bit like Scrabble, in that hard-to-use letters have more points. You've got to form words. It's just a fun game. My wife and I have been playing it heaps and, getting a lot of fun out of that one. So if you're looking for a board game, dear listener, I highly recommend Quiddler. So Quiddler. I don't get any commission or receive any royalties for that. It's an honest review. You guys got anything that you're grateful for? Anything good happen? Anything you want to share of your personal lives before we move on?
I've had a couple of interviews just recently. I've still got to wait back to hear from one and another one that's coming up for me on Wednesday afternoon.
Thoughts and prayers, Scott?
Yeah, we can shove your thoughts and prayers.
Joe, anything for you?
Nothing exciting. There are a couple of games that I do play.
Mm-hmm.
There's a word game that someone I know in the UK has written. I've just shared it in the chat, which is called Cell Tower,
mm-hmm.
Which is just a little brain teaser. Renews every 24 hours, and you can work your way through trying to work out. Basically, there's however many words in a block of letters,
mm-hmm.
And you just have to work your way out the right number so you don't paint yourself in a corner by picking the wrong words and end up with letters left over.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. That's a single-player game. There's also an online jigsaw puzzle game,
mm-hmm.
which you can actually play with multiple players, which we've done.
Very good.
It does kind of stifle the conversation, though.
Mm. Just back to Quiddler. You obviously have arguments about whether a word is a valid word. So we bought an old dictionary from a secondhand bookshop. And if it's not in that dictionary, it's not a word, because you can go online and there's all sorts of BS words online on these online dictionaries. So if you do end up with Quiddler, buy yourself or get a hard copy dictionary so you don't have to look up phones. And, yeah, there's a little tip there. So, right.
I remember playing Scrabble with Mum's partner and he refused to accept that quoll was a valid word.
Okay, it's just an animal, isn't it? It's a quoll. Well,
I mean, he's from the UK. Right. Nobody's ever heard of it.
Well, that's where if you're using a UK dictionary, he might have challenged you, because it may not be in there.
I think it's in the Oxford English.
There you go. So, yeah. All right. John in the chat room says, are you going anywhere near the Lerman result? And the answer is no, because I haven't even heard the result. What was it? Well, maybe we are. Scott, all right, careful. Be careful, Scott, not to commit any acts of defamation.
Well, I'm not going to commit any. I'm just going to repeat what the judge said.
Oh, okay,
good. The judge said that, as far as he can tell, that she and Lerman had sex in the Parliament House, and that he also said that he didn't believe that it was consensual.
Wow.
So he had actually.
Wow.
It certainly sounds like the judge has come down on the side of the prosecution, but the judge, he actually was at pains to say that the burden of proof in a civil case is a lot lower than the burden of proof in a criminal case. So as far as he was concerned, there was no judgment on his guilt or innocence, but it was just saying on the balance of probabilities, he probably raped her.
Therefore, the defamation case failed.
Was thrown out, yes. Correct.
Wow. Yes. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And said that he had doubts about the credibility of both witnesses, but that Lerman was, I think he said something like economical with the truth when it suited him, something along those lines.
Mm.
But he said he didn't believe that. I think either witness was completely truthful.
There we go. Well, I mean,
it's one of those things. It's just, you know, like I said, it's not a burden. The burden of proof is very different under a civil case than what it is in a criminal case.
Mm.
So the judge was at pains to actually point that out.
Yeah.
Whatever article I was reading basically said, in a civil case, you can just say this is the most likely explanation, whereas in a criminal case, you have to say you've excluded all other explanations.
Mm.
And so the Lerman case starts to joins up now with what's becoming a longer list of defamation actions that were started and that backfired on the people who started it.
It's blowing up in his face. And the judge even said something about I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said something about, you know, he's come in here to collect his hat and it's been thrown back in his face, you know, which is just one of those things.
And there's still the Toowoomba trial to go, isn't there?
I believe so, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, because it has been a weapon, this sort of defamation threat, that there's these huge payouts are possible. And sometimes you have to question whether they were in line with the actual damage to reputation or not. But anyway, people might maybe start to think twice a bit more. I mean, I think
that's two high-profile cases that are blowing up in their faces.
Yeah.
You know, like you've got the soldier, can't remember his name.
Robert
the big boy.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry?
Robert Smith.
Robert Smith, yeah. Yep. You know, he sued and that's all just blowing up in his face.
Yeah.
And now you've got Lerman sued and that's blowing up in his face. Yep. So,
and I think there was a recent thing where there was reports made about Alan Jones and basically he hasn't started a defamation suit. And maybe in past times he might have thought about it, but seemed maybe learning some lessons from the current, you know, from those two cases. So, yeah.
Well, one would hope so, because it's just I'm just a little bit concerned about the level of litigiousness that's already going on in Australia.
Mm.
We're becoming a very litigious community, just like the United States, which I just don't think is actually good for us.
Yeah. You just want a genuine assessment of somebody's reputation and how it's been damaged and, yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, I would never have assumed that a defamation case was going to win because I remember the Jeffrey Archer case.
Who's that?
Jeffrey Archer.
Jeffrey Archer. Mm. He was a novelist back in the UK.
Mm.
And he was accused of, I think, cheating on his wife.
Yes.
And he basically sued for defamation, lost, and then was, I think, jailed for perjury.
Yes.
He was jailed anyway, and I'm fairly sure it was in relation to that case.
Yes.
So, yeah, that was in the 1980s in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of said, you can't just the thing about defamation is very much if it's a person who's rich and threatening somebody who's poor, they can't afford to defend themselves.
Mm. And then there was Lance Armstrong was basically warding off inquiries from people with threats of defamation when people were right. writing things or wanting to write things about his doping. I think he was threatening defamation as a means of stopping that being exposed. So, yeah.
The US has got a very different defamation system over there, don't they? Yeah,
particularly if you're a public figure, it's kind of
yes.
Almost
you have to
all bets are off if you're a public figure.
Well, you have to prove that they knowingly told a falsehood.
Yes.
Or that they acted in such a way that they should have reasonably known.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that they were not just, oh, well, I thought it was different. You have to prove that they should have known better.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe one of those rare areas where the US legal system might be closer to the mark of what's the best. So, yeah. Well, there we go. So, John, I wasn't planning on it, but there you go. Some hot takes on that decision. A sorry state of affairs, really, for our media. Just I don't read the nuts and bolts of it, but just the way that he was entertained and rent paid. And
allegedly. Yeah, that was bloody disgusting.
Yes, allegedly, thank you, Joe. Allegedly entertained. Yeah,
they were allegedly entertained with allegedly by hookers and drugs and everything else. Those are the allegations that were made.
Yes, just doesn't paint a good picture of
– no.
Journalism in this country. Now, the Bondi Junction stabbings.
Yes. Did you notice in a certain private Facebook group that somebody had posted some discussion literally hours after it happened going on about the religion of peace and how it was obviously a Muslim because he had a big, thick beard?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I saw an interview with the mother and that sort of stuff of him, and she did not look like Islamic or anything like that. She just looked like.
No.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. I'm not sure where you gents stand on this, but I said years and years ago to my brother, who's a psychiatric nurse, I said to him, you know, speaking as a purely non-professional from that field, I would suggest that the closure of asylums and everything else in Australia was a mistake. And he said, yes, I agree with you.
Mm.
So he reckons that...
We don't have asylums?
Sorry?
We don't have asylums?
We don't have them. No, you have to be a threat to yourself and others to get locked up in them.
Right.
See, whereas prior to that, you could actually commit someone who wasn't a threat to themselves or others. So I would have thought that this bloke who had been under the treatment of physicians and everything for about 18 years, that they would have actually said, well, that's serious enough that we've got to lock him up.
Mm.
But anyway, the government chose to close them down many, many moons ago.
The argument was the modern medications meant that people could live a full and active life in community.
Mm.
However...
You've got to
only if they're taking the drugs.
Exactly. Yeah, which is exactly. One of the things. If you're not going to take the drugs, you're going to end up falling off that wagon and you end up fucked up again, which means you're sleeping on the street, you're potentially a victim of violence, or you're potentially a perpetrator of violence. Now, I think to myself, what would that mother actually prefer? Would she prefer to go and visit her son once a week in a mental hospital where she knows that her son was being medicated and looked after and everything else? Or would she prefer just to go and visit his grave now?
Having been on psychiatric wards, they're not a place you'd want to be.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. They're not very nice places at all. But if you compare that to the number of people that are living on the streets now, you know, it's just one of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, my experience was that I was getting into an elevator in this apartment building, and there's an elderly couple on the same floor who I know, and they said, oh, they were heading in the elevator to go down to the shops to buy the newspaper, and I immediately was like rolling my eyes because that clearly meant only one newspaper, which was the Courier Fail. And as we got in the elevator, the lady said, oh, I think we just said, oh, wasn't it terrible what happened in Bondi? And she said, yeah, terrible. And, you know, somebody should tell that Albanese that that was one of his immigrants. That's, you know, somebody should tell him. And I was like, at that point, I only sort of just heard that he was a Queenslander. I said, well, I've just heard he's a Queenslander. And she was like, oh, really? But I just thought, man.
Yeah, these people from Toowoomba, you can't trust them.
Scott being from Toowoomba.
Yeah, I was from Toowoomba.
But
yeah.
I thought, wow, on a matter like this, we have people are prepared to reduce that to party politics.
Yeah.
And just it was really disappointing. And, you know, they're a nice couple. But I just thought, this fucking Murdoch rag, if it just the way it's propagandized people into being able to take that view.
I don't think it's just that. I think whoever you hate the most, you're going to, if you're small-minded, you're going to immediately assume it's whoever you hate.
And you're looking for an excuse to blame whoever you hate for everything that happens that's bad. So it was like, really? Just on a day like this, and you're ready to lay it at Albanese's feet. And I was thinking to myself afterwards, I should have thought even quicker, like I should have told her, no, it was one of Morrison's immigrants. Actually, it might be one of Dutton's, not Dutton.
Costello's.
Abbott or somebody like that. Because it was just the assumption that it had to be Albanese's immigrant. It was just really depressing. But there we go, right. Anyone got anything more to add on that, or we'll just move on?
Well, so which immigrants were the Wee and Billa shooters?
Were they the ones out past Dolby? Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think they were any immigrant from anywhere except white Anglo-Saxon from...
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah. Well, maybe they weren't, Joe. I don't know. Just you can't say that by looking at somebody, can you? Like,
well,
they might have identified as Indigenous. I don't know. Didn't hear that come out. But, yeah, that was depressing. All right.
Yes.
We're going to talk about housing now. So there was a poll out from Essential asking people about to what extent would you support or oppose the following housing policies in Australia? And remove tax concessions like negative gearing and capital gains tax discounts for property investors. Overall, 24% strongly support and 27% somewhat support, and 30% were neutral. Only 19% would oppose that. So we're reaching the point where the majority of Australians are ready to remove negative gearing and capital gains tax, according to this Essential poll. So there's a mood out there for change is brewing, I think. Unfortunately, in the same poll, I asked people about a policy of allowing first home buyers to access their superannuation to help them purchase their first home. And unfortunately, 57% 8% of people were in favour of that and 25% were neutral. Dear listener, all that will do, allowing young people, is boost up the price of housing. Saul Eslake, Scott, you listen to the 7am podcast.
Yeah, and I listened to him this morning. He was very articulate. He laid the blame right at Howard's feet. And he said that, you know, everything Howard did was just going to inflate the prices.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what has happened.
Yeah. So he was.
And it's one of those things. Howard has never made any secret that he hated the capital gains tax. He hates it.
Mm.
And he actually tried to, he wanted to repeal it, but they all said, no, you can't repeal it. So we did the next best thing, which is where he gutted it.
Mm.
You know, it's.
Now, were you a card-carrying member of the Liberal Party at the time, Scott?
Oh, I was, yes, a card-carrying member of the Liberal Party.
And did you think at the time, well, that's a good idea?
No, not really.
Right.
I did actually have some questions of it.
Okay.
Because I didn't think it was that bad what they were asking you to do, to calculate the post-inflationary gain was all you paid tax on.
Yes.
Which was very reasonable.
Mm.
So if your property price... If your property price went up above the inflation rate, then you paid tax on that. And then they also had another thing that said that that couldn't push you up into the next tax bracket or anything like they calculated the total tax on that at the highest rate of tax that you're currently getting charged, which was quite reasonable. Now, what they've done is they have just slashed it and they've said that, you know, you hold something for 12 months, you sell it, and you make a profit on it. You only have to pay tax on 50% of that. Now, I don't know whether or not you still I don't know where you actually get that, whether or not it – I can't remember what it was called. I think it was – anyway, averaging or something like that on the income tax. You know, I'm not sure if you still get that averaging or whether or not you actually pay tax at the
– I think people who have a very variable income – can average it out over a few years if they've had a spike for some reason of some sort.
Yeah, but that's
I don't know if that's still the case. It used to be.
That only relates to farmers and those sorts of people. You've got that was where you average your income out over a few years.
Is that what you're talking about?
No, but the averaging was something that was given to you if you were in receipt of capital gains. And that was to make sure that you didn't actually get boosted up into the top capital and you didn't actually pay rate tax at the top rate on the capital gain. It was at a lower rate because they averaged it out. So I'm just not sure if that's still the case or whether or not they just throw the 50% of it into your income tax and you just pay the tax on that. I couldn't tell you.
My memory, Scott, when capital gains was first introduced by Keating? Is that right? I think
19th of September 1985 was when it started.
Yeah, and basically it was announced that night like in a budget or something like that?
I don't know where it was announced. It was either announced by media conference or it was announced in the budget. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, but it was pretty much the day of the change, which was from now on.
Exactly.
From this moment onwards.
19th of September
1985. Yeah. There was... assets bought prior to that time would be exempt.
They were pre-CGT and they were exempt.
Correct. And assets bought after that time would then be subject to the new capital gains tax regime.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know, I just have a memory of it being a bit of a shock and a bit of a well-kept secret or just it sort of was just announced very suddenly and there was no opportunity for people to quickly acquire assets.
No, there wasn't because the assets and everything, if you didn't own it by September 1985, then you were fucked.
Yeah, yeah. So it was done in a way that stopped people from quickly buying assets to get in a pre-CGT situation.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
You know, it was done like that.
Yeah. Those were the days when people made decisions and said, boom, here it is.
Did that have a depressionary effect on assets that people were investing in?
I couldn't tell you. It's been years. I couldn't tell you.
Can't remember.
It's just one of those things. Like, you know, I don't understand why Howard had such a philosophical hatred of it. It was just trying to take something.
Because it makes rich people less rich.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose so. But anyway, it's one of those things. Like, see, up until then, there was a reason why you had to there were all these cases about whether or not something was capital, whether or not something was income.
Mm.
If it was capital, it was exempt from income tax because it was only a capital gain. So you didn't actually get taxed on it. After that, it didn't really matter because, you know, the profit that was in excess of the inflation rate was what you paid tax on.
Yes, wasn't it?
Which was quite reasonable. It was quite reasonable. And I don't understand why the hell that they didn't want to actually maintain that.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. Well, just on the essential poll still, you know, the figure I gave before was for just the overall sample that they took. So all people, all ages, all genders. And looking where it breaks up, say, by age, pretty much there's not a lot of change. But people's views on getting rid of capital gains tax and negative gearing, you know, very minor differences in the age groups. So I found that interesting. And even in voting intention, not a lot of difference amongst the different groups, Greens, Labor, Coalition, Independents. You know, as far as these things go, in kind of agreement on this. So we've reached a point.
I did notice actually it was the 35 to 54-year-olds that were most against any change. Whereas the pensioners seem to be as happy that things changed as the young people.
Yeah. Let me just see here. So for the removal of the capital gains and the negative gearing, you say by age. So in the younger cohort, 18 to 34, 55% were in favour. And in the older cohort, the 55 plus, it was still 48% were in favour of changing negative gearing and capital gains tax. So given the divide often in the age groups on other issues that we've looked at, I thought that was a relatively small difference.
Yeah, I think it is. But I was surprised that I was expecting the LEPs to be the reactionaries and go, I don't want any change. And it seems to be 35 to 54, which is going to be families sort of, you're already set up, you're in your house and you're just hanging on, you don't want any depreciation of your assets maybe.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that I do worry about, you know, because we can all talk about everything with housing prices and all that sort of stuff. However, if they do actually go down, and if they go down by a substantial amount, then that will depress the economy because people will no longer feel as wealthy because their housing prices have gone backwards. It's one of those things.
Well, Scott, if they're not owning a house, though.
If they're not owning a house, I agree, they're going to love that. They're going to love that because the prices have come down, which will make them more affordable for people.
And that'll be a boost to the economy. If, in fact, we get to the position where more people don't own a house, then that sort of policy could be expansionary.
I don't see how it could be expansionary. It wouldn't be expansionary because you're taking established homes and making them belong to someone else.
Well, if you
you've also got these other people that are going to record losses and all that type of thing. And this is the other thing, like capital gains tax, you pay tax on the gain. You don't get a tax deduction for the loss.
Nobody's going to suffer a loss though.
I know that, not now. But anyway, it's one of those things. If you were to actually depress house prices enough that it comes down, then you know you're not going to be able to.
One of those
reports actually said that the removal of capital gains and negative gearing would create a 2% change in the value of houses,
which is no problem at all.
Well, exactly. And that, yes, there would be a big shift in the ownership of houses, so people would get out of the investment market, but that slack would be taken up by people who are currently renting. So really it would have very little effect on the cost of houses. It just means that more people would be in would be living in a house that they owned.
John Siemens, where do you listen to Eastlake Scott? I listened to him on the 7 a.m. podcast this morning. They've got a five-part series on the housing disaster, I think it's called.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's
part one was today. It was very good.
Yeah, part one was today. It's very much worth looking at, you know, worth listening to. It was very good. Yeah.
And the Saturday paper had an article. The Saturday paper and the 7 a.m. podcast are both Schwartz.
They're both Schwartz Media. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was where that came from. And Salt Eslake's very good. Just
paying tax is never reasonable, according to Landon Hardbottom.
Hello, Landon. just on house prices then, in the same poll, they asked people, would you like to see house prices continue to rise, reduce, or stabilise? And overall, 15% wanted continue to rise, 45% wanted stabilise, and 40% of those surveyed wanted prices to reduce. That was a significant number and probably matches the number of people who don't own a house, I would say, at this point. So, yeah. That one, of course. Sorry, Joe.
Look, if you're a housing market, you don't care whether your house goes up or down, really. But you might want it to go down for your kids.
So, true.
Unless you're leaving an area, unless you're leaving the bubble, do you care about where the bubble is?
Yes. True. Yeah. What else was on here? Views on the Australian housing system. So these were the options people were asked. Our housing system is working well, doesn't require change. Or the housing system is not working in some parts and needs change in those areas. Or the housing system is broken and needs to be fundamentally rethought. And only 9% of people thought the housing system's going well, 47% wanted some tinkering, and 43% say the system's broken and needs to be fundamentally rethought. So, and that one about being fundamentally rethought was pretty much even across the age groups, like 42%, 45%, 44% from young, middle-aged to elderly all thought the same thing. So, again, pretty common, unusually sort of uniform thinking by Australians on this issue, that the system is got some real problems. Yeah. So
it's one of those things, like, you know, I know what Landon's saying, you either got to have fewer people or more houses. Well,
the Bondi guy was trying to remedy that.
Yeah, I know that.
Too early, Joe. Too
it's
soon.
It's one of those things. You can't actually have a population that goes backwards, because that will end up fucking up the economy. And if the houses and everything that we've got and that sort of stuff, if they become some kind of runaway excuse to make a hell of a lot of money on, then, you know, it's just one of those things. You've just got to make a decision as to which is better for you, you know. I'm not sure why it has got to this sort of level, because we have had high migration in the past and we have coped as a country. We have managed to put everyone in, under a roof and everything else, and we've also managed to employ them and everything else. It's just, I just don't understand where it's all gone wrong.
Well, we're trying to work that out in this podcast, aren't we? So
yeah, we are.
We've blamed negative gearing and capital gains. But we've blamed also land banking that we looked at last week, where it's developers sitting on approvals and not actually releasing the land, because to do so would cause a drop in prices if you had too much supply. So there's that issue. There's the way to counteract that is to have more public housing put onto the market, supplied by the government, because the government doesn't need to make a profit from it and, in fact, wants to depress it. So if you were to to get the government to be creating more public housing, that would be a solution. And in the podcast this morning, Scott, Saul Eslake, I think, or one of the commentators was saying how there was a significant amount of public housing built during the Menzies era.
Yeah, I know. And it's one of those things, it's something that Menzies was very proud of.
Yeah, and it was the neoliberal policy of privatising everything, less government, that led to Australia, as well as other countries, but Australia in particular, pulling back and ceasing that sort of public housing building that had been a significant component of sort of the Menzies era. And unfortunately, the tax concessions that were brought in, one of the arguments was it would lead to the creation of more housing, but it turns out the investors just bought existing houses and didn't actually create that many new houses.
Exactly. It's one of those things. I don't understand what the hell was the problem with
public housing.
What the hell was it? What the hell was the opposition leader's name at the time? Shorten. I don't understand what the hell the problem was with his policy. You know, he just said that he wasn't going to.
Murdoch didn't like it, and he created a great scare campaign.
Yeah, I know, but it's,
and we got Morrison.
We got Morrison instead, which is, that's history. But you've just got to look at him. What he was actually saying was he just wanted to have negative gearing only available for new builds, which honestly I think makes perfect sense.
Interestingly, our foreign investment laws, when people wanted to buy residential property, they could buy new units, for example, but they couldn't buy existing properties. So that was
Is that still the case?
I'm pretty sure it would be, but I haven't looked at it for a long time. But that was done as a way of at least foreigners buying property would have to be encouraging some sort of new building. They couldn't buy existing ones. So
I know in London that there are laws saying that for every, whatever it is, 10 high-value apartments that you build, you have to buy 5 affordable apartments.
Right.
And so friends in London have said basically you get a tower block with one entrance on one side, which is for all the rich apartments, and one entrance on the other side that's for all the poor people.
Well, at least it's there. You can't
bump into the poor people. Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah. It's basically saying, to get approval for X number of houses, you have to provide affordable housing in an equivalent amount.
Yes. There was an article in the John Menadue blog by a guy, Michael Keating. He put forward some interesting ideas. One of them was looking at the increase in population versus the increase in the number of dwellings since 2017. And over the last 7 years, the increase in the number of dwellings has exceeded the rate of population growth. So where people like Peter Dutton want to blame immigration for the housing crisis, he's got the statistics that show that.
How many kids does Dutton have?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe it's his fault for breeding too many.
Yeah. Anyway.
See, that's one of the things that I just don't understand is that if they actually looked back on the proudest days of the Liberal Party, which was when Menzies was in charge, apparently. You just got to look at us. We were awash with migrants. We were awash with public housing. We did those two things at once. Why the hell aren't they trying to copy that again?
Yeah. Another statistic he gave here was an increase in house prices and the increase in dwelling construction costs. And somewhere like Melbourne, for example, between 2002 and 2010, median house price increased by 8.6%, but dwelling construction costs increased by 4.6%. So that meant the land cost increased by 4%. In the following 10 years, the Melbourne median house price increased 4.5%, construction costs increased 2.4%. That meant that the land increase had to be 2.1%. And from 2020 to 2023, the median house price in Melbourne rose 18%. Dwelling construction costs rose 7.7%. So basically the cost of land increased by 11.3. So some of these statistics show, okay, we've had some periods of high construction costs, but there's also been in there periods of very high increase in the actual land component, not just the cost of housing. So that's adding more information to the puzzle of why prices have gone up. And he argues that we need more higher density sort of suburbs using less land, therefore.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you know, makes sense.
It's one of those things like where my place was in Brisbane and that sort of stuff, that was supposed to be zoned for units and that type of thing, but the LNP government knocked that on the head and they said you can only have units up on the Logan Road. So anything that was off Logan Road was deemed to be, you got to have bigger blocks.
Mm.
So I was able to split my block, but it's just one of those things.
In the same article, makes the point, first homeowner grants, stamp duty exemptions, things like that, they just don't lead to poor people getting houses. They just lead to higher house prices.
Yeah.
Because these people are now competing with each other. So if you give them a $50,000 sort of bonus.
Or robbing your superannuation.
Yes. It just
means you have less superannuation.
Yes. Yes. So yeah. And then in the Saturday paper was an article, The Men and Decisions Behind Australia's Housing Crisis, and that sort of was following along the same lines as the podcast you listened to, Scott. One of the interesting anecdotes in that was that Howard was interviewed on a radio program Brisbane Radio, 2003, John Howard was being interviewed. Since the election of the coalition government 7 years earlier, house prices had doubled. And Howard's interviewer wanted to know what the government planned to do about it. And Howard said nothing. Howard said, quote, "I haven't found anybody in 7.5 years shake their fist at me and say, Howard, I'm angry with you for letting the value of my house increase." And so that's been sort of cited with frequency over time. But there was actually something that followed that statement, and the interviewer responded and said, "Well, let me be the first to complain. People like myself are actually being forced to face the possibility we may be renting for the rest of our lives because getting into," and he was interrupted at that point, and Howard said, "Do you own a home?" And the host said, "No, I rent." And Howard said, "No, well, I'm sorry. I was talking about people who own a home." So essentially his concern was only for people who owned a home. And,
yeah.
Well, nobody's complained to me. And the interviewer is saying, "Well, I want to complain." And Howard goes, "Well,
also, I suspect Brisbane prices went up in that period because they were incredibly undervalued because of Sir Joe's legacy."
Yeah, possibly.
And people finally realised that Sir Joe was gone.
Mm.
And that they could take their money from selling a Sydney or Melbourne house and retire on the difference.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. But at that point, it made sense politically for Howard to favour people who owned a home because they were the majority and you got the most votes by pandering to that cohort.
But now that majority has got their adult children still living with them at home, it's starting to turn.
Yeah. This is just one of the ongoing problems about the boomer generation is that they were such a large voting block who by age and circumstances had similar interests that governments were forced around the world to kind of, okay, all those guys are educated, let's now charge people for the university degrees because it's not affecting the boomers. Let's now introduce superannuation because that's what the boomers want. And just a range of policy decisions that were made with an eye to democracy, Scott, like we make decisions that best help the majority of people.
The tyranny of the majority.
Yes.
The tyranny of the mass. Yeah, I can't remember all the phrases.
But unfortunately that meant a particular large voting group got particular favours, and that was perhaps detrimental to the long-term viability of the country. That's sort of one of the failings of a democracy.
Yeah, but I'd still prefer to live in Australia's failed democracy than live in the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, but I'm just saying it's one
or
of
the Russian Federation.
Yeah. But I am just saying it's one of the things to consider. What else did it say in here? When Howard came into power, 42% of people owned their home free and clear with no mortgage. 42%. And 28% had mortgages. Let me just see.
Yeah, but they were mortgages of 18%. It was a different mortgage than you get these days.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't that high back then. You know, it's one of those things. The boomers would love to have you believe that they paid 22% interest on a $400,000 house. They paid 22% interest on a $60,000 mortgage.
Yeah.
You know.
So in 2002, the average retirement age was 55.
Yeah.
Gee, that was low, wasn't it?
It was very low. But, you know, it's
just what's going on in this world?
We're
going backwards.
I'm very, very pissed off about it because it's one of those things I just think to myself, you know, in a happier bygone era, I'd be thinking to myself, I've only got 5 years left of this shit. So, you know.
Yeah, that was the other thing. As the boomers have got older, the retirement age has been bumped up.
Mm.
So, yeah. And they have bumped it up and up and up.
Yeah.
And I just think to myself, if you actually want to solve the youth unemployment problem in this country, you've actually got to encourage some of those boomers to pull out of the workforce now.
Mm. Okay, let me just finish the statistic here. 2012, average retirement age was 55, and only 4% of homeowners aged over 65 carried mortgage debt. By 2020, so 18 years later, the average retirement age was 64, and more than 50% of homeowners aged 55 to 64 still had mortgage debt. So within 20 years, significant mortgage debt on those people. What else have we got here? Negative gearing. So one of the arguments is that if you were to get rid of negative gearing, then rents would go up. And you may ask yourself, dear listener, well, we'll never know, will we, until it actually happens. And in this article, they make the point that the experiment has already been run. So the Hawke government dropped negative gearing in 1985 and reinstated it in 1987 following sharp rises in rents in Sydney and Perth. So that seems to be an argument against abolishing negative gearing. But Saul Eslake and others point out that rises in those two cities, Sydney and Perth, were a consequence of a shortage of supply. And contrary to that, in Brisbane and Adelaide, rents actually fell and the abolition had no impact anywhere else in the country. So if you want to take that experiment and the word of Saul Eslake, then negative gearing, if it was to be dropped, would not lead to increases in rent. So at the time, Labor buckled in the face of in what Saul Eslake calls a thoroughly dishonest campaign by the opposition leader John Howard, invested property interests. And the usual media suspects, and they restored negative gearing and, of course, introduced halving of the capital gains. So what else is in this article that's of interest? We've mentioned before how much it costs to have these deductions.
I told you about land valuation, by the way.
What part was that, Joe?
My recent land valuation.
Oh, yeah, it went up
30%.
Yes.
Yeah, it's 2 years. So that's 15% per annum.
Congratulations.
No, not really. It means absolutely nothing to
Congratulations on your higher rates bill.
Well, exactly.
Pass that on to your tenants. Oh, wait, you don't have any.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can't claim it on negative gearing either.
Anything else of interest in this? I think that's enough sort of stuff to have in your head at the moment about, here's an interesting one. In the 7 years to the mid-2019, the median Sydney home earned more than the median full-time worker. So basically the average Sydney home in a seven-year period increased in value at a yearly rate greater than the average median full-time worker.
And it only paid half the tax on that.
Yeah, yes, indeed. There's some amazing statistics, isn't it? What else was there?
Well, it would be interesting to put together how much foregone tax, negative gearing, and halving the capital gains.
It hasn't actually halved the capital gains tax because, you know, you would assume that you would be paying tax on 100% of the gain. You never were. You were only paying tax on the post-inflationary gain.
Yes.
Which was probably 80 to 90% of what you were paying. So you probably cut it by around about 30%. You haven't actually halved it.
Well, according to this article, negative gearing costs $27 billion per annum. And the CGT discount costs $19 billion per annum. 20 or 30, roughly $50 billion per annum. How many subs is that? It used to $50 billion used to get you 12 subs. And at that time, it was outrageous.
Yeah, but now you're talking about $300 billion for 10, wasn't it?
That we'll never get.
Yeah, exactly.
$360 billion.
Yeah, so that's $30 billion a sub.
Yeah. So, yeah, $50 billion a year is what that's costing us.
So 1.5 submarines a year.
Yeah. Look, you know, it's probably 10 Japanese subs a year, isn't it?
So, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
There was a question that now the Japanese are joining AUKUS.
Yes.
Do we get a discount on the subs?
Maybe we could get Japanese subs now.
Okay. It was more... Can we get a group rate?
Oh,
between Japan and us, yeah.
But Japan makes their own; they don't need to buy.
Yeah, but Japan doesn't make nuclear powered submarines.
And well, exactly. So why are they joining AUKUS if not?
Because AUKUS just sounds so good.
No, okay. They are joining to get access to American technology, which is hypersonic missiles and that type of thing. And they're also joining to get a greater air defense shield and everything like that. It's just
And they really don't like the Chinese.
Well, they really don't like the Chinese, but they do have a fairly vexed history with China. Now, I know Japan started that war, but China has never forgiven them for it.
No, they're very bitter about that. I remember
they are very bitter about it.
I remember my homestay boys, Chinese, were very bitter about Japan. Yeah.
It's one of those things, like, you know, I was in China, I don't know, when I went over there years ago to go visit my brother. And there was a television show that was highlighting the atrocities committed by Japan. And they had it in English subtitles, Japanese subtitles, Korean subtitles. They had all the subtitles on there just to actually try and get the message across that the Japanese were bastards. You know?
Yeah, they're big on that.
And I've got no doubt that they were pricks to them for sure.
Yeah. Actually, in this article, there was another interesting anecdote. So around Halloween, October 31, 2020, we had big storms in southeast Queensland cause $1 billion worth of damage. A lot of that was down sort of Springfield way, as I recall. Just every house in the suburb lost, you know, badly damaged roof. Lots of hail damage. And what he says is, it took 2 weeks for the increase in demand for roof plumbers in Brisbane, to hit the price of roof plumbers in Melbourne. It literally just swept down the country. So incredible demand for roof plumbers in Brisbane. And 2 weeks later in Melbourne, price of roof plumbers went up. Anyway, all these interesting things that come into play.
So the 2 weeks was for the Southerners to realise there was a quick buck to be made and jump on a plane.
Yes, or they could simply say to their boss, you pay me extra or I will go on a plane to Brisbane and I've got 2 years' worth of work up there at this crazy rate, so you have to match it.
I remember when the cyclone came into Yeppoon, and a mate of mine who is up there said a big truck turned up 2 days after whilst things were still shit. Filled up with Bunnings generators that he'd bought at $500 a pop at Bunnings in Brisbane, stuck on the back of a truck, drove up to Rocky and was flogging him at $2,000 a pop.
Right.
Bastard.
Because the power lines were down there.
There you go. Yeah.
What a prick.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so that's more information to put in your kit bag about trying to explain Australia's housing situation.
Yeah, I still don't think that negative gearing is entirely to blame, because Canada doesn't have negative gearing and Canada is also suffering the same sort of housing crisis that we are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't remember which city it is. I think it's Vancouver, where prices have shot up ridiculously high over there.
Just one city?
I don't know if it's just one city or whether there's all their cities. It's just, it is what it is. I've got a negatively geared property in South Ripley. There's no doubt about that. So you could be ignoring everything that I have to say here, but I just don't think it's entirely the fault of negative gearing. I think it is. I think it is certainly to blame, but it is not entirely to blame.
Well, that's the whole point of this conversation, is we're saying there's a whole host of factors involved.
Oh, God, yeah, there's a shitload of factors involved.
And the podcast with 7am made a good point about culture, that Australia has, for various reasons, become a culture of landlords, property speculators, and of DIY improvement. So we are way into DIY improvement much more than a lot of other cultures around the world.
I agree.
But also our rental system is set up for short-term rentals. So I've got a friend who's just moved into an apartment in Germany, and the landlord was basically talking about 10 years' time.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, the expectation was that, and it's a studio. It's not even a one-bedroom apartment.
Right.
And, you know, I wouldn't expect anyone to be in a studio for 10 years. You'd be thinking you're going to be married and have a family, and you can't have kids in a studio. You want a slightly bigger place.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the assumption was that he was going to be in there long term. There was no, this is a six-month lease and at the end of 6 months we're going to jack your rent up.
Yeah.
No, but you can't even do that now. You've got to wait 12 months between rent increases to actually increase the rent again. Yeah, it's just
All right. Some good news. Scott Morrison has been busy signing copies of his book, Plans for Your Good. It's hot off the presses. You can pre-order your copy today from Booktopia.
So are you going to read it and review it for us, Jeff?
No, I'll wait till it's in the $2 bin. I won't have to wait long.
Well, I just think I'll just go borrow it from the library, because I'm not really interested in giving that bastard any more money.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, once we get off air, I'll tell you a story up here.
Okay. All right.
That's not really salacious or anything like that. But anyway. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll make baby Jesus cry.
Yeah.
No, it's not going to make baby Jesus cry.
Yeah. I won't go into it. There was an article by Alan Patience in the John Menadue blog, basically talking about how with elections now, one-third Labor, one-third Liberal National, and one-third independents, which are either teal or green or Jackie Lambie or whatever, and that we're moving away from what was the case. And Guy Rundle wrote a piece in Crikey looking at the Tasmanian situation. So the Tasmanian Premier pulled an early election. They changed the number of parliamentarians and increased it, but the Liberal vote didn't match that increase. And they're kind of a parliament that's a bit of a one-third, one-third, one-third. And the Liberal government is forming a rough coalition with the Jackie Lambie network and seems to have enough to guarantee supply. Labor refused to get into an agreement with the Greens, just point blank refused.
Yeah, I know, which is one of the things that I do not understand, but it makes me think that perhaps we're not privy to what the Greens actually do when they get into government.
Or maybe we're not privy with how right-wing Labor are.
Yes.
Yeah, that's also a possibility.
Guy Rundle's theory was that the Liberals and Labor are much closer in ideology than any of the other groups. And in fact, there should be a grand coalition of Liberal and Labor with the Greens as the genuine opposition. It's just that they couldn't bring themselves to admit how close they actually are. He doesn't say it in so few words. It's a bit more flowery, but, you know, this is what happens. You talk about Europe and renting. Well, over there, there's a lot more of these sorts of mixtures of coalitions of smaller parties.
There are.
Yeah. And we're heading that way now.
Yeah, but then you also get the case of Israel, which was very much a proportional representation, and they were held to ransom by
the right wing
conservatives.
So that's where Likud had to go in with them, and they have now reaped what they've sown. Mm. You know, I would have thought that if Benny, whatever his name was, prime minister and that sort of stuff, this war would have been over months ago, because I think he would have flattened Gaza. And
Netanyahu?
Whatever his name is, Benny Gantz, was it? Was that the?
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I would have thought that if he was the prime minister over there, they would have flattened Gaza and then they were pulled out and they would have said, right, you want these borders open again? Give us back our people. You know? Because I just don't see the point in continuously bombing the...
Isn't that the first part of the plan you just mentioned? Flatten Gaza? Aren't they still doing that?
Yeah, I know, but they flattened...
They just haven't finished it.
They could have actually stopped. You know, they could have flattened it and then they could have stopped. But instead, they've got this obsession with going in and, you know, rooting everything out and all that sort of stuff. And I think to myself, you know, Hamas was a creation of the Israeli government because they wanted something that was against Fatah.
Mm.
You know, it's...
Okay, well, let's talk about Gaza and the Middle East. So Iran recently, in the last few days, sent a bunch of missiles / drones plus firecrackers across to Israel, who were busy with their Iron Dome intercepting those objects, and some got through, but apparently there was only one injury from that entire project, which seems extraordinary. So the coverage of this has been affected by the stabbings in Bondi. So here in Australia, you know, turning on the news, not a lot has been said about it. But what if you do look at the news and you read a Murdoch paper, because that's the only goddamn paper out there, or Fairfax, which are just as bad. And they talk about, everybody in the world has been warning Iran, don't do it, don't send missiles, but they did it anyway, and this is just a goddamn Iranians.
Well, and I read a thought that they gave them plenty of warning, they knew that the Iron Dome was going to stop them, effectively this was Iran showing not was saving face. They'd been attacked. They had to save face.
Correct.
This was the way of doing it.
And how had they been attacked, Joe?
Because they had their embassy blown up in Damascus.
In Syria?
Yeah.
You would not know that that happened in Australia.
Well, I knew about it.
Well, how did you know?
Because I read it on the ABC weeks ago when it happened.
So when Iran retaliated, it was because the Israelis attacked their embassy
in Damascus.
It was actually the building beside the embassy, technically, I think, but, you know, with the intent of and killed a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And people are expressing shock and horror at the Iranians retaliating. Just imagine if somebody had done that to a US embassy anywhere on the planet. There'd be no question about the retaliation that would be expected.
That then Hillary Clinton would be blamed.
Yes. Yes. But
it's
just
one of those things, you know, I just don't understand why the hell they decided to bomb that embassy. You know, I just think to myself, that bastard is trying to extend this war. He's trying to keep them going and that sort of stuff. He's trying to drag the Yanks into it.
Yep.
But I was very pleased that Biden has already said, no, the Israelis are on their own over this.
Apparently that's a red line that was never crossed in any previous sort of world wars or major conflicts of attacking your enemy's consulate like that in another country.
Not by a nation state, no.
Yeah. So
by terrorists.
Yes, but not by a nation state. So I think Israel has yet to claim responsibility, but the USA said, yep, Israel did it. So
the Yanks said Israel did it, so they're on their own.
Yeah, and there are all these warnings given because different Western powers were saying to their citizens, do not go anywhere near these areas. It was because the Iranians had said, we're going to send some bombs as a retaliation, missiles. And anyway, they've sent them and they've said, that's it. The project's over as far as we're concerned. It was in retaliation for what was done to us and we're done now. We're not doing any more. But that's
they have said to Israel, don't retaliate for the retaliation.
Yes. Yeah. So interesting.
Which I don't blame them for.
Interesting move by the Iranians. So,
yeah, of course. It was a very interesting move by them.
Yeah. So, headline in the New York Times, Israel bombed an Iranian embassy complex. Is that allowed? Question mark. And Alan McLeod makes the point, imagine if Iran just bombed the Israeli embassy in DC. Would anybody be asking if it was legal? Good point. Just a dearth of background material on that. And, you know, I saw comments by Penny Wong urging Iran not to escalate the conflict. And when they did, Albanese decried Iran's actions and said, Iran has ignored our call and those of many other countries not to proceed with these reckless attacks. Anyone who cares for the protection of innocent life must stand against these attacks. Albanese continues, this escalation is a grave threat to the security of Israel and the entire region. It risks greater instability and devastation. And he says, Iran's ongoing flouting of international law, its egregious human rights abuses and threat to international security is why this government has imposed targeted financial sanctions and travel bans, he said. Now, I Googled and tried to find anything where Australia condemned Israel for the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, and I couldn't find anything. So it's just the hypocrisy and the double standards that just are annoying. Again, that might have been affected by the fact that the bombing of Damascus embassy, or the embassy in Damascus, was on the 1st of April, and that was around the very next day was when that aid worker was killed. Zomi?
Yeah,
Zomi?
It could well have. Yeah, Zomi, whatever her name was.
So again, the media was just full of of that tragedy and not much about an Iranian embassy being hit by the Israelis.
Yeah, was it done with how'd they do it? Did they do it by aircraft or did they do it by cruise missiles?
Not sure how it was done. Not sure.
Usually it's aircraft. Mm. And the attack on the nuclear processing plant was aircraft.
What else have we got on this? I showed image on one episode of those guys who were hit by, you know, walking along. There's some terrible stuff you can see online. One is, this one is reported extensively in a Guardian article. Israeli soldiers taking pot shots at a starved Gazan clinging to a bag of airdropped food aid. The soldiers wounded him repeatedly. He kept struggling to crawl to safety and they continued shooting for no reason until they murdered him. Cold-blooded murder in broad daylight. You can see that on Twitter. And what's another example here? Just going back to the Australian aid worker who was killed, and, you know, like the uproar here in Australia and by our government saying, this is outrageous. The Israelis have crossed the line here. I demand an explanation. How dare this happen? 30,000 Palestinians die and nowhere near
this. Yes, but they're not Australians.
I know. It's so pathetic to be so parochial and to just ignore 30,000 people being killed but then get all just the reaction when one Australian does is really so small-minded. I mean, by all means, express the outrage for the Aussie aid worker being killed, but a proportionate amount of outrage for the 30,000 Palestinians who have been killed might be nice or consistent. You know, by the way, why was she there? Potentially because Australia had pulled back its funding of UNRWA, so groups like the ones she was with had to come in and sort of fill that
feed
void.
The poor bastards. Yeah.
Fill that void. So, you know, is Australia partially responsible? The drone that killed her was by a company that Australia is paying big sums of money to as part of an agreement between military supplies from. So something like, where is it here? The lady's name was Zomi Franken, killed by a drone, and we're handing $900 million to the company that helped murder her. So the Israeli arms company that provided the tools for the murder will be handed $900 million by Australian.
Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
Yes. This is from an article in Crikey. And in February, the ABC revealed the Defence Department had awarded Elbit Systems a $917 million contract, despite equipment previously supplied by the company being torn out of Australian systems due to national security concerns. And so they're going to be handsomely rewarded by Australians. Was there any mention that, hey, Albanese, if you're so outraged by the murder of this Australian, do we reconsider paying $900 million to the company that supplied the drone that killed her? People like Richard Miles just simply refuse to respond when people like Crikey ask questions like that.
Well, they just made the weapon. They didn't target it.
Yeah. Just all the outrage. But when you can do something, they're not prepared to do it. The Onion had an interesting headline, satirical. It's like the Chaser or like the Batuta Advocate headline in the Onion. Israel warns Gaza still harbouring hundreds of doctors. I mean, they're killing just hundreds of doctors. What else have we got here? We've got...
mind you, so is the NHS.
Yes. But there's articles where doctors, both Palestinian and foreigners, are saying, look, lots of kids are killed by, you know, bombs and by rubble falling on them. But we're also seeing groups of kids just brought in with gunshot wounds to the head and no other adult victims. And the snipers are just picking off kids in the streets. And then various reports by Palestinians and Twitter videos of people lying injured in the middle of the street, bystanders unable to move to the middle of the street to try and pull them out of harm's way, and the snipers just continuing to take pot shots at them. Like, it is dystopian what is going on there. What else have we got? Places like Germany, there was a professor who's Jewish. She's been disinvited from a guest professorship in Germany for signing a public letter in support of Palestine. The letter was just a pretty simple document about supporting Palestine for the most obvious of reasons. She's been banned from her position. Yiannis Varoufakis has been... there's just been an order made against him, a ban on any political activity in Germany for Yiannis because of his support for the Palestinians. And it's not just a ban on visiting Germany, but also from participating via Zoom. So some pretty heavy censorship occurring in Germany.
Because, you know,
anybody who's
Germany feels a hell of a lot of guilt over the Second World War.
Yeah.
And they actually feel personally responsible for the Holocaust. And I just think to myself, it's time for them to get over that too.
Yeah.
You know, because they are a modern, fully functional democracy now and that sort of thing. They can still have the history, but they've got to actually move on from it.
There's reports of the Israelis using AI for targeting of people, and also reports where when they've sort of located the activities of junior Hamas operatives, they've preferred to kill them in their homes rather than out in the field. This is a method of war. And, there was an extensive article in The Guardian about snipers targeting children. Gauze. You guys, when you put like a bandage on, referred to as gauze. So it comes from Gaza because Gazans were skilled weavers for centuries. So that's where the word gauze comes from. What else have we got here in this just litany of disasters? So it's just incredible the level of brutality, cold-blooded killing, and it's just continuing right in front of our faces, and it's not stopping. These people are now starving. Allegations, even someone like Bob Carr, former New South Wales Premier, said, you know, that attack on the Australian aid worker was probably to scare off and stop aid workers operating. So in his view, it was an intentional act to scare off aid workers and to reduce the level of aid going into Israel, not just some simple mistake. You just couldn't put anything beyond them at this point. So on the whole, they're doing terrible things. The Australian government has been very limited in its response. Australian government is sending over a guy to talk to the Israelis to investigate the murder of that aid worker. Mm. And
well, he's not going over to investigate. He's going over to advise the government on the investigation.
Right.
So he's going to actually be the Australian witness for the investigation and that sort of stuff. So he's going to be sitting in on meetings and all that type of thing.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Exactly.
Yeah, and meanwhile...
Well, I hope he speaks Hebrew.
Mm.
Because what's the odds all the meetings won't be in English?
Yeah.
No, they won't be in English. They'll be in Hebrew.
Yeah. And there we go. A complete disaster. Australia doing nothing about it and, in fact, paying big money to the company that's made the drone that killed the Australian. And meanwhile, criticise the Iranians who are retaliating because their embassy was bombed by the Israelis. So they go to town criticising them, but not the Israelis. It's all so two-faced. It's all so hypocritical, quite depressing.
And, that it is.
And there we go. That is another episode. So, all right, well, dear listener, sorry for the audio last week. I'll try and fix that up. So long term, it'll be better. But anyway, we'll be back next week. We'll talk to you then. Bye for now.
And it's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from him.
Good night.